Okay, so I couldn't bear to give up on either of two topics, so I'm just gonna try to fit them both in. I just want to get across the gist of two different things. Okay, so let's first talk about prion models. Not because these have ever turned out to be very successful, but because it's clearly a very interesting thing, and I just have the feeling people haven't thought enough about it. So, you know, somehow the goal is, in a way, the opposite of the other beyond the standard model ideas that we've had so far. Most beyond the standard model ideas are that, you know, as you go to higher energies, there's more particles that we haven't seen yet. And the idea here is that instead, if you have a finer microscope, you resolve that there's actually fewer particles than we think there are. So, you know, so reduce the fundamental constituents. Of the universe. And so the motivating examples here are, you know, the hundreds of atoms and isotopes in the periodic table. Were understood to be really just different configurations of three particles, the proton, the electron, and the neutron. And then late more recently in the 60s, the many different strongly interacting particles that were found in colliders, many different mesons and baryons, a whole zoo of them, were understood by Neyman and Gell-Mann to really be just different bound states of three quarks, U, D, and S, and then now we think there's three more, but okay, so now if we look at the standard model, the zoo is not quite as zoo-like, but there's still a lot of stuff in it. I mean, so if you count up all the different types of fermions, including color and the fact that they come in two different SU2 flavors and left and right, then there's, you know, there's 48 different fermions in the standard model, and plus their antiparticles, and then there's the various different bosons, of course, the Higgs boson and the photon and the Z and the W plus and minus and the gluons. So it's a lot, you know. Seems like it should be. Well, it's tempting to look for a model that has fewer basic constituents. It sounds weird that the fundamental constituents should be that many or more. And then, you know, there's another point, which is that another, if you want, motivation is that, you know, everyone has learned since gauge theories have been so successful, the standard model is a gauge theory, as Justin can tell you, and general relativity is also a gauge theory of a sort. So they both have huge gauge symmetries. So we've learned to love gauge symmetry and regard it as a great organizing principle. But you know, viewed a little bit more objectively, it's a weird thing. It really says that there's a gigantic redundancy in our description of the standard model. If two different configurations are related by a gauge symmetry, we don't regard them as different physical configurations. We regard those as just two redundant descriptions of the same physical state. So it seems odd that in a fundamental theory that you would have tons of redundancy, tons of extra redundant information in the that's unphysical in the description of it. And the goal of going to higher energies and trying to build a theory with even more redundancy like that arguably seems backwards. Yeah, and you might think that really what's going on here is that if you had the fundamental constituents, if you were somehow able to find the fundamental constituents and write the theory in terms of those, well, if you just had the direct physical objects, then there would be, you know, this one is in this state, that one's in that state, bam, that's the state of the system, there would be no redundancy, and that somehow the gauge symmetry arises because when we map from the fundamental objects to the effective objects that we currently use to describe the standard model of particle physics, that there's somehow in this mapping that there's many different ways you can do the mapping that are really equivalent. And so the mapping is just very non-invertible. That somehow the gauge symmetry is about that. So in that sense, gauge symmetry looks like it might be another clue that there's a more reduced way to describe things. And so people have had a couple clever ideas along this path, although, as I say, none has really managed to be completely successful. But I just wanted to mention, partly because it's cute and partly because it's simple, one of the earliest suggestions was this so-called Riesz model, proposed by Harari in 1979. And you know, here the idea is that there's basically two fundamental constituents. There's a one which he calls V, which is a spin 1/2 particle with charge 0, and another one which he calls T, which is a spin 1/2 particle with charge non-zero. In particular, to agree with normal convention, we'll normalize the charge to 1/3. Okay, and then the idea is that, kind of like in QCD, where you only see bound states that are triplets of, you know, the baryons that we see are all triplets of quarks. The idea is, oh, well, maybe the particles, the fermions in the standard model are triplets of these things. And so if we write down the possible triplets here, one is TTT, then there's 3 with a single V. Three with 2 Vs. And one with all these. Okay, and the idea is that this is a thing with charge plus 1. And this is a triplet of things that all have charge 2/3. A triplet of things that all have charge 1/3. This is a triplet of things that all have charge 0. And so the proposed interpretation is that this is nothing but the positron. These are the three colors of the up quark. These are the three colors of the anti-down quark. And this is the anti-neutrino. The neutrino, the electron neutrino. And then, okay, I've only written down the things triplets of Riesz, but if you include the anti-Riesz, like T bar, T bar, T bar, okay, you get the antiparticles of all of these particles. So if you think about it, if you include all of these particles and their antiparticles, you get a complete generation. So one generation seems to neatly describe one generation of standard model fermions and their antiparticles. And then the idea is that the proposal was that then all the bosons could be described as also bound states of these things. So for example, the W plus is interpreted as a bound state. If you ask So if you take as the basic rule that these fundamental constituents, the number of V's and T's, you know, the number of V's is conserved and the number of T's is conserved. So maybe a VV bar pair can be born or a TT bar pair can be born, but the number of V's and T's is conserved. Okay, so then there's another conserved quantity in this picture. In addition to the electric charge, there's the baryon minus lepton number. So this thing would have baryon minus lepton number equal to minus a third, and this thing would have baryon minus lepton number equals plus a third. And so anyway, if you ask, you know, what can I write down that has charge plus one and zero baryon minus lepton number, the right quantum number is to be this thing, you find it has to be like VVV, TTT. And so then if you think of this as like an operator that can act on a fermionic state, it can act on some triplet of objects. So for example, imagine that it acts on T bar, T bar, T bar, so that's the antiparticle of this, so that's an electron. Then these T's can come in and annihilate those T's and you just have the three V's left over, so that would go to some state like VVV, which by our table here is the electron neutrino. And so that seems to represent some process where W plus electron goes to electron neutrino, which is indeed an allowed process in the standard model. Anyway, so there's the idea is to think of the various bosons as fermions we see as composites of these more fundamental particles. And anyway, so you'll see that as I described it so far, it's very, you know, it's like more of a thing you write down in a napkin than a theory. It's not really, there's no dynamical theory yet. So people tried. There was a paper in 81 by Harari and Nathan Seiberg trying to write down a dynamical theory of this model, or several papers really over the next few years. So they have this kind of nice discussion in their first paper. They have this nice sentence in their first paper about this, which is that you know, we've given a lot of thought. They say something about, in the introduction, we've given a lot of thought about how to write down a dynamical theory that describes this, and we've come to the conclusion that there's basically two extreme options. There's a kind of radical option. There's a kind of conservative option where the dynamical theory that we write down is just another Yang-Mills theory. Or a more radical option, which seems to involve, would seem to involve non-associative algebras or some sort of more non-standard ingredient. And so they say, we're going to try to see how far we can get with the more conservative option, just writing down another Yang-Mills theory. So they have this theory that they write down, this proposal, which is that. They propose as a dynamical theory, as a theory where it's the gauge group is SU3C times SU3H. So this is the ordinary color SU3, and then this is the so-called hypercolor SU3. This is the thing, and the idea is that these two things have two coupling constants, and the gauge coupling for the SU3C is smaller than the gauge coupling for the SU3H. So as they both theories are asymptotically free, so as you follow their beta functions to higher energies, both couplings get smaller and smaller. But as you follow them to lower energies, both couplings get bigger and bigger. And as they get bigger, we know that when G sub C gets larger than one, when we get to low enough energies, the G sub C gets larger than one, this becomes a confining gauge theory, and all the quarks are confined into baryons, triplets. The idea is that this coupling constant is even bigger, so it crosses one first. So at higher energies, first this SU3 becomes confined, so all the Riechons get confined into triplet particles, like those there, And below that scale, it looks like we have a theory that, has just this symmetry, just this color. So the basic fields, the basic thing they want to take is they want to say that the two fields are the, so now T and V are reinterpreted in this theory as T is a fermion field that transforms under this gauge group as a 3, 3. So it transforms under the fundamental with respect to both gauge groups and has some global electric charge 1/3. And V instead transforms like a 3 bar 3 with global electric charge 0. And the idea is that the proposal is that you just write down the theory with just the gauge boson kinetic terms for this, and then the normal Dirac kinetic terms, you know, T d slash T plus V d slash V plus, you know, V T bar d slash T plus V bar d slash V. For fields charged this way. And then, well, they can't really calculate in detail. A drawback of that, for the first drawback of this conservative approach is that the whole idea is that this simple fundamental theory gives rise to the standard model we see when all of these things bind up due to the strong coupling, due to the confining phase. This thing becoming so strongly coupled that this gauge group becomes confined. But the problem is, famously, we don't really know how to calculate how confinement happens. We don't really know how to show, even in QCD, that quarks really do confine, or at low energies, or in what combinations they do combine at low energies. So they can't do that either here. But they do have some indirect plausibility arguments. And so they kind of, I don't know what to say, they don't derive, but they argue in a way that is tantalizing that what you get when you flow this theory down, after you look at the effective theory after this thing becomes confined, is a theory that is a low energy theory that has now a gauge, they argue that new gauge symmetry emerges at low energy. This becomes confined and goes away. You don't see it anymore. This you still have, so that stays. But they argue that there is some new gauge symmetry that emerges. In fact, their claim is that the new gauge symmetry that emerges is exactly the... In short, they claim to get exactly the left-right symmetric model that I was discussing during all of yesterday's lecture. So that's kind of interesting. They argue that it's natural to expect all of the different fermion fields and boson fields of the standard model to emerge in this theory as composite objects built from these guys. Although, again, they can't calculate it directly, but they can check that certain things have the right quantum numbers, that certain simple combinations have the right quantum numbers. And they even claim to be able to derive that sine squared of the Weinberg angle. Remember, this is the Weinberg angle. It measures the difference between the U1 and U2 couplings, SU2 couplings in the standard model. They claim to derive that this thing is 1/4 at some scale, presumably maybe the scale at which this thing confines. And that's kind of nice because this is actually measured to be 0.23 or something like that. So anyway, so there's a bunch of things that seem plausibly very cute about this theory, but it's hard to compute with. In addition to that problem, you know, there's another more general problem which they really don't offer a resolution to, which is that which is a general problem with prion models. If you want to interpret them as really coming from yet another, you know, if you want to just say below the layer of reality we currently see, the standard model, there's a deeper layer, but it's another Yang-Mills theory, just like the standard model. The problem is that we measure, we see experimentally that the leptons and fermions of the standard model, leptons and quarks, I meant to say, appear to be point-like as far down as we can probe them. And we probe them experimentally in various ways down to roughly 10 to the minus 18 meters or something like that. And so, you know, the problem is that if these things are really going to be reinterpreted, so let's say we probe them down to this energy scale, let's call that L. So if you reinterpret that length scale, as an energy scale, so that energy scale is, you know, given what we now know from the LHC, this is something like hundreds of GeV. Let's say. And you know, the problem is that if you have a bound state of particles trapped in a little well whose width is this small, you know, you expect that bound state to have, by the uncertainty principle, if you've confined the particles to a tiny little area, the smaller you confine them, by the uncertainty principle, the bigger their kinetic energy is. So they have a very big zero-point energy, and then all that zero-point energy is trapped inside the bound state. To an outside observer, it looks like mass. So it's hard to understand in these models how it can be that you would, if these are really all bound states trapped at least this small, it's hard to see how they wouldn't have energies. So why are the masses, you expect masses for the quarks and leptons that are bigger than hundreds of GeV. And that's just not what we see. Instead, we see the quarks and leptons are a lot lighter than that. So it's a puzzle. That's always made it seem a little bit implausible that this is the right path. So, you know, I can't help but be interested in the other possibility that they mention, the more radical possibility. I mean, this thing that they mention about non-associative algebras, you know, it so happens that this table of eight objects has a strong whiff of the Octonians, that this is very like a structure which appears in the Octonians. As soon as you fix one imaginary Octonian and call it preferred, the other ones, the eight Octonians, group themselves just like this, and there's a sense in which they have exactly these quantum numbers under SU3 and U1. I think there could be something interesting here. This is not an idea due to me. This goes back a long way, and people have been thinking about this ever since the 70s. Because I want to move on to the second topic. Let's see. I just want to mention that I don't claim that there's anything that works yet along this direction, but I think it's interesting and worth thinking about. And I also want to mention another thing which seems related to all this to me is that there was an interesting paper from earlier this year from, I guess it's archive 1808 something 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 by Dubois, Violette, and Todorov about the exceptional Jordan algebra, which is the 3x3, which is the algebra of 3x3 Hermitian matrices. There are these things called Jordan algebras. Those are just the algebras of Hermitian matrices. I'll talk more about those in a second. Hermitian matrices, you can't just matrix multiply them and get another Hermitian matrix. You have to take their anti-commutator to get another Hermitian matrix. So that kind of algebra where you take matrices and take their product by taking their anti-commutator, that's called a Jordan algebra. They were famously classified by Wigner. So Jordan algebras classified by Wigner, von Neumann, and Jordan. You know, Jordan had the observables in quantum mechanics are Hermitian operators. And so Jordan wanted to reformulate quantum mechanics in terms of, okay, and also the density matrices are also Hermitian operators. And so Jordan had this bright idea that he could reformulate quantum mechanics in terms of Hermitian, entirely in terms of the observables and the density matrices, entirely in terms of Hermitian operators. And so it became natural to, so that reformulation, everything is written in terms of Jordan algebras. And so these guys got interested in classifying them. And it's another example of this story that I mentioned before, that they find that there's basically three infinite families, the n by n Jordan algebras over the real numbers, n by n Hermitian matrices over the real numbers. That's one infinite family. There's n by n Jordan algebras over the complex numbers. There's n by n Jordan algebras over the quaternions. And then there's 3 by 3 Jordan algebras over the octonions. 3 by 3 Hermitian. I think I may have been saying out loud differently than what I meant to say. So this is the algebra of n by n Hermitian matrices with real entries. This is the algebra of n by n Hermitian matrices with complex entries. These are n by n with, where each entry is a quaternion. And these are 3 by 3 complex matrices, 3 by 3 Hermitian matrices where each entry is an octonion. Okay, and actually there's a fourth family here. I'm kind of lying to make the story sound good. There's a fourth family here, which are the Clifford algebras, but with, so the algebras of gamma matrices, but where you take the anti-commutators of the gamma matrices. So Clifford symmetrized. Anyway, but to a first approximation, there's this story again, that things are classified in terms of the norm division algebras that I talked about in the first lecture, and there's one exceptional case now. And these guys have been interested. It's another old dream, like the same group of people who are mystically interested in the octonions, like myself, I must admit, are also mystically interested in this exceptional Jordan algebra. And just to say that these guys make an interesting observation about the connection of that thing to the standard model, and it all connects to this whole Riesz-Schön idea. Okay, that's all I wanted to, that's just a teaser, really. I just wanted to draw your attention to that. Now, I was just going to move on, if you don't object, to a different, related, but different topic, which is trying to reinterpret the standard model in terms of the language of non-commutative or non-associative geometry. So it is related, really, in the sense to what I was talking about just now at the end. But anyway, but let me just sort of restart. Although it's a good point to pause, maybe. And so, last joke. Anyone? You've been completely milk dry? Okay. This is a joke my grandmother used to tell, since she was a sort of star of these breaks of this particular course, was, do you know this one? What sits out on the back porch and speaks Irish? She was Irish. She liked this joke. What sits out on the back porch and speaks Irish? Patio furniture. Thank you. Okay, so non-commutative, non-associative geometry. Did that joke? Did that joke? That it was, yeah. It just didn't go over well. It wasn't like yesterday where it was just incomprehensible. It was, it just did not produce laughter universally, although in the, for a few people it did. Okay, so non-commutative geometry / non-associative geometry. So you can ask yourself a couple of questions. You know, you can sort of be led in this direction by a couple of different questions. So in the first, in the transition from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics, famously, you know, in classical mechanics, there's one way to formulate it is in terms of the Hamiltonian formalism, in which case the basic object you're working on is the phase space manifold, which is an ordinary manifold. And then in quantum mechanics, the coordinates on that phase space manifold are promoted from ordinary real functions satisfying a commutative associative algebra to, they're promoted to a non-commutative algebra called the Heisenberg algebra. Defined by the relations Q commutator P is equal to IH bar. And coordinates. And correspondingly, if you think of the manifold of observables, normally the coordinates on that are promoted to non-associative algebra. They all become Hermitian operators, Hermitian matrices. So they're promoted to a commutative but non-associative algebra that we just described, Jordan algebra. Okay, and again, remember that a Lie algebra, which physicists know and love, is basically where you take anti-Hermitian matrices, and then if you have an anti-Hermitian matrix, and you just take its matrix product with another anti-Hermitian matrix, you don't get another anti-Hermitian matrix, so they don't form an algebra under the ordinary matrix product. Instead, to preserve anti-hermeticity, you have to take their commutator. Okay, so that's what a Lie algebra is. And the Jordan algebra is the flip side of that. If you take the product of two Hermitian operators, you don't get a Hermitian operator. Instead, you have to take their anti-commutator. Okay, and so you might wonder, there's another manifold that we all know and love, which is the space-time manifold. So in the ordinary way that we formulate general relativity coupled to quantum field theory, so far we've not promoted the coordinates on space-time in any way. We've not done any analogous thing here. Instead, the coordinates are just treated as labels in the for the field operators in quantum field theory, or in the path integral approach to quantum field theory. You might wonder whether they should be similarly promoted in some way, or in particular, you know, at least relative positions are observables. So you might wonder if we've already promoted the coordinates on the, if this is really in some sense part of this manifold of observables, should it be getting promoted in a way analogous to this? Or I mean, not just analogous. Should it get promoted to? Should we be considering, in some sense, manifolds that are generalized by letting the coordinates be Jordan algebras? lie in Jordan, be drawn from Jordan algebras. And in particular, you know, if you think about the ordinary coordinates in U's and GR, you know, you, on some patch here, you choose, let's, if this is some patch of a four-dimensional manifold, when you choose coordinates for it, you, what you really mean is you're choosing four different functions on this patch, the four different coordinates, four different real functions. So you're choosing, so the coordinates are drawn from the algebra of smooth functions on your manifold M, smooth functions which are valued in the real numbers over each point at M. And then it's the automorphism group of this, so let's say this, so this is the algebra of coordinates in ordinary physics, as we normally formulate it at the moment. And the automorphism group of this algebra is exactly the diffeomorphism group of the manifold, which is exactly the symmetry group of GR. Okay, if instead we promoted this thing, we let this thing, we did something analogous to here, we now let the coordinates be valued instead of just in the real numbers in some fancier algebra. Okay, so now we consider smooth functions on the manifold, but now the value of the function instead of just being a real number can be valued in some algebra, fancier algebra AF, which where AF stands for finite. So now the automorphism group of this thing is, well, there's still the diffeomorphisms of the manifold, the group of coordinate transformations on the manifold, in other words, in sort of physicist language, but then semi-direct producted with a gauge group which is the group of maps from the manifold to the automorphisms of the algebra AF, a new finite algebra we added here. So in other words, if we choose this algebra AF to have as its automorphism group SU3 times SU2 times U1, then suddenly the automorphism group of the algebra of coordinates over the manifold will give us the diffeomorphisms of the manifold times the gauge group of the standard model. So the full symmetry group of the standard model coupled to gravity would be reinterpreted in this language as just like the generalization of what we used to just call the diffeomorphism. So that one advantage of going to of promoting things in this way, one reason to think this might be a good approach is that then we can bring the gauge symmetries together, we can put them together with the diffeomorphism symmetries of GR into, we can treat these all as diffeomorphisms on some bigger, fancier manifold, or some bigger, fancier space of some type, I should say. Something M prime. Okay, so that's one line of thought. Alternatively, you could ask yourself a second question. You could look at the fermions of the standard model. Okay. You look at all the spinner fields appearing in the standard model. Well, they depend on the space-time coordinate x. But then there's, like, as we said, there's 48 different ones. So they also have some discrete index here, A, which runs from 1 to 48. And you might wonder whether you can put these two labels on more of a common footing. So normally we give a nice geometric interpretation to this label, but this guy has no particular interpretation. I mean, that's part of the key problem. That's one of the key problems in Beyond the Standard Model Physics. It's this is just some label that we seem to have to add to the model in order to describe the whole slew of fermions that we see. But yeah, it would be nice if we could have some more unified way of understanding these two parts together. That's another way of saying it would be nice to be able to unify the Yang-Mills part of the physics with gravity. So then we would just have a single, instead of thinking of, you know, a weird collection of 48 spinners over our manifold. So instead of living on M, our four-dimensional manifold, we would just have, you know, one spinner, psi, on some product space, M times F, where this is the four-dimensional continuous manifold labeled by that 4D continuous coordinate. And this is some finite space whose exact nature we still need to become clear about, which is in some sense labeled by these discrete coordinates. Some finite discrete space that we still have to understand what it's about. Okay, or then a third question you might ask yourself is many people for many reasons have suspected that in some sense massless particles are more fundamental than massive particles. Mass in many ways just mucks up the works, and like for example and it looks like you might hope that a fundamental theory would be formulated purely in terms of massless particles, and the masses that we see would be emergent in much the way that most of the masses in the Standard Model are that way, in the sense that they're reinterpreted as really coming, only arising as an effect of spontaneous symmetry breaking when the Higgs obtains of F. So, can we reformulate things so that everything's massless? In particular, if we look at the fermions, you know, if we look at the free part of the Standard Model Lagrangian, there's some kinetic terms and there's some mass terms. Can we rewrite this thing? Okay, now here there's some index, I and j. Can we rewrite this thing as just a kinetic term, but on our bigger space, M times F. Just purely a massless field, but a single massless field, but living on this product of ordinary space-time times some discrete finite space. So if you want a picture of this, you know, the picture would be that, you know, you've all seen this picture drawn for string theory, probably, where string theory wants to live in 10 dimensions. For some reason, we only see 4 dimensions. And so the usual idea in string theory is that there's the big 4 dimensions that we see, and then the remaining 6 dimensions that the string wants are curled up into some tiny continuous manifold living over each point in space. Okay, some 6, so there's some little 6-dimensional curled up thing, some Calabi-Yau manifold maybe, and then 4-dimensional space time. And so this is kind of like that, but the idea is our four-dimensional space is the same, but the extra-dimensional space is not a continuous manifold now. It's not a six-dimensional manifold just like ordinary space. It's some discrete thing, which we want to figure out exactly what it looks like by looking at the clues given to us by the Standard Model. So some sort of discrete, finite, extra dimensions, if you want. So, well, let me just tell you a thing that a thing that works, a thing that, you know, I've been giving the motivating questions, but so what's the idea? So I want to take, and okay. There's an exactly analogous story for the standard model, but as we've seen, the standard model has this rather messy table with a lot of bits and pieces. Whereas Patti Salam is a bit more unified, and so it's a bit simpler to write down. So for speed, let me to just give you the gist of the idea. I'm going to write down the Patti Salam version of this, but there's a closely analogous story for the standard model. So I propose to take as my finite algebra I was saying there's these Jordan algebras, n by n Hermitian matrices over reals, complexes, quaternions, or octonions. I'm going to take the 4 by 4 and 2 by 2 Jordan algebra over the complex numbers. Okay, I'll take that as the finite algebra that, in some sense, my new generalized coordinates live in. And I've chosen this algebra because it turns out its automorphism group is SU4 times SU2 left times SU2 right. In other words, it's the Patti Salam group. And because I can neatly embed it in a block diagonal 8x8 matrix. Okay, so if I divide my 8x8 matrix into 4x4 blocks here, I'll put these two 2x2 blocks on the upper diagonal. So I'll put J2 left up here and J2 right here. And then I'll put J4 down here. And then so the coordinates are an 8x8 block diagonal matrix. I want to put the 16 fermions of the standard model and their antiparticles into a 4x4 block off diagonal matrix. Okay, so along the diagonals here, we have 4x4 blocks, which are 0. But then on the off diagonals here, we'll have some psi, which is 16 psi 4x4. So these are 16 spinners here. And these are the corresponding anti-spinners. So remember that there are 16 spinners in a single generation of the standard model. But let me just remind you of the counting there. So that's if we take Q left. Well, there's three colors times up left, down left is 2. So there's 6 of those. There's U right, which is 3. D right, which is 3. And then L left, which is 2. Nu right, which is 1. And E right, which is 1. So that's a total of 16 spinners. So that's where we're going with this. These are going to be those. These are going to be the corresponding antiparticles. OK, well, the idea is that so there's a natural sense in which these two things, they're both 8x8 Hermitian matrices. They form a net. So if we call this thing AF and we call this thing HF, the Hilbert space of spinners, these two things naturally form an algebra together. These can, of course, they can naturally, of course, act on each other by matrix multiplication or by anti-commutator, I should say. So they form this algebra AF plus HF. And you can ask, under the automorphisms of this algebra, how do these guys transform? Well, again, the automorphisms are exactly the Patti Salam gauge group. And you can check. So the automorphisms, the way you, if you wanted to check it for yourself, what you would do is you would take the auto, it turns out the automorphisms are generated by, instead of 2x2, 2x2, and 4x4 Hermitian matrices, you take 2x2, 2x2, and 4x4 traceless anti-Hermitian matrices and take their commutator with this. And if you do that, you'll see that these 16 spinners break up into exactly the way the spinners in a single generation of the standard model break up under Patti Salam, and these things break up exactly as their antiparticles. And so which I feel I'm going fast here, but it must be done. There's no next lecture. There's nothing I don't know. I just want to get across the gist. I understand it's a little bit too fast to be fully comprehensible. So that's the idea. So far, we've promoted our algebra. In quantum mechanics, we promoted the manifold of observables, the coordinates to Jordan algebras. Well, we just did that the same thing with the space-time manifold. We were thinking of the space-time manifold as part of the space of observables now. So it seems, in that sense, maybe not so crazy that. That its coordinates should be promoted to Jordan algebras, and we've in particular chosen a Jordan. It turns out there is a nice Jordan algebra, a rather simple one that acts in a natural way on the space of fermions, such that. Exactly like we wanted from this motivation. Now the automorphism group of the algebra of coordinates is exactly the symmetries of GR combined with the symmetries of the standard or Patti Salam, I should say, in this example, with the fermions transforming correctly under Patti Salam. And so we have this kind of structure again that we have a product of two spaces, our continuous manifold M, and parameterized by the ordinary four-dimensional coordinates we know and love, and then times a finite space F. So now, when you have a product of two spaces, so let's say you have one space M1. Suppose you're just talking about two ordinary manifolds for a second. How do fermions behave? Suppose you have a one manifold M1, and you have some spinners on that manifold, which have a Dirac operator D1. And let's suppose for a moment that it's a even dimensional manifold. Then there's a chirality operator gamma 1. And similarly for M2, it has some Dirac operator D2 and some chirality operator gamma 2. Well, really, here, I want to think of M1 as our ordinary four-dimensional space-time manifold. So what I really mean here is the Dirac operator is I times D slash, and the chirality operator here is what you would normally call gamma 5. And then here, this is our finite space, so this is some Dirac operator. This is some other operator. We don't know quite what it is yet, but I'll call it df, d on the finite space, and then this thing would be gamma on the finite space. But so, just sticking with the general structure for a second, when you take product of two spaces, it turns out that the Dirac operator on the product space is the sum of two pieces. There's the first piece coming from the Dirac operator on the first space, so that's d1 on the first space. Sorry, let's say, I should have said. So this Dirac operator acts on some Hilbert space of spinners, H1. This one acts on some different Hilbert space of spinners, H2. So when we take the product of the two manifolds, the Hilbert space of the full manifold is some H1 tensor H2. That's the full space of spinners on the product space. And the Dirac operator that acts on that looks like D1 tensor 1, the identity operator on the second part of the Hilbert space. And then plus, well, you might think it's 1, the identity operator on the first space, tensor D2, and that's almost right. But it turns out this thing is actually a chirality operator. You get this thing to still have the properties of a Dirac operator. So that's true even if you just take the product of two ordinary manifolds. But here we want to do that with our finite space. So we want something that looks like D. I d slash, where this is just the four-dimensional coordinate derivative, times the identity operator on our finite space, this 48-component finite-dimensional Hilbert space of standard model fermions. This is gamma 5. And then this is our mysterious df. Okay, so that's what we would want the Dirac operator on our product space to look like. Well, let's just look at the free part of the standard model Lagrangian, the fermions. So it has some form like this. It has some form that it's a sum over all the fermions of I d slash times delta ij, and then minus some mass term, mij, times psi j. So now if we reinterpret psi j as the coordinates, as the label on the finite part of the space, we can indeed just rewrite this as psi bar I d slash tensor 1 on the finite space plus gamma 5 tensor df, where now we see that df is really just the mass matrix in the standard model with an appropriate minus signs pulled out in some terms in order to pull out this gamma 5 here. So now the point is, so we say, great, it looks like once we take this perspective that space-time can be a continuous part, the ordinary 4D continuous part times a finite part, it looks like we can rewrite the free part of the standard model Lagrangian as just reinterpret the kinetic plus mass term as just a kinetic term on a bigger space. But now remember, why is it that the standard model doesn't just have its free part? What are all these interaction terms about? Well, remember that we want this thing to transform under the gauge group. Or in particular, in our case, we want it to transform under the automorphism group of our algebra. So under the automorphism group of our algebra, the automorphisms are SU4 times SU2 times SU2 times diffeomorphisms. So psi transforms to in some way under U psi. And just like we did back in lecture 2 or lecture 3 or one of those early lectures, we said, well, to have a Yang-Mills theory, we have to demand that D transform covariantly. So if we want this thing to transform like this, then in order to build an action that's invariant under those automorphisms, under those symmetries, D had better transform covariantly like this. And so, to make a long story short, because I'm running out of time here, maybe I won't write down, the formulas are in the lecture notes, but you know, the gist is, back when we did this exercise in the second lecture, we only had this term. We asked, does it transform covariantly? We found out, oh, no, it doesn't. There's a term that's good, but then there's a second term that's bad. And so we had to modify this term. We had to add to this term a gauge boson term. So we had to rewrite it like We had to add a gauge boson term, which in our current notation would look like this. It's that here's the generator for the gauge. For each generator of the gauge group, we have to contract with a gauge boson. But now, since we have a second term, when we're doing our test, when we do this, we do the same test we did before. But just like this term generated an error term, and we had to introduce a field with the right transformation properties to cancel off that error term. Well, now this term, we'll find, introduces a second error term, which violates this desired formula. And we'll have to introduce a second field here to cancel off that error. Okay, so this term will look like, you know, you find that in order to get what you need to add here to make this transform like that, is you again have to add a field, phi sub capital K, let's call it, times some matrices, tau sub K. And the point is just, you know the symmetry U that you want. You know the mass matrix that you want. So it's just a matter of computing. You just calculate how it actually transforms. It doesn't transform like this. You look at what you need to add to correct. And what you find is that you need to add over here exactly the gauge bosons that you normally need for Patti Salam. But then here, what you're really adding is exactly the scalar fields that you need, the Higgs fields for Patti Salam. And if instead we had done this for the standard model, so instead we had taken as our algebra, the appropriate algebra that embeds in an 8x8 matrix there, but now has as its symmetry group SU3 times SU2 times U1, what we would have found is exactly the gauge bosons for the standard model. Okay, that's all normal. But plus, the added benefit of looking at things this way is we would have gotten out, by the same unified argument, the Higgs boson of the standard model here. Okay, with the right charges. One Higgs boson with the right charges to be the standard model Higgs boson. So, the point is that, the point is that this way of looking at things has some explanatory advantage over the usual effective field theory way of looking at the standard model. If you think about our table one last time, I won't write down the table, but you can ask Justin if you need it in more detail. You can ask a couple of questions. You know, one thing that comes that's nicely explained here is that, so ordinarily, you know, you specify the gauge groups of the standard model, and that specifies the gauge bosons, the spin one particles, but it doesn't specify the Higgs fields. In particular, there's nothing about that. Once we had specified the gauge group for the standard model, and all the fermion fields in their representations, we're still in the normal effective field theory approach. We're still completely free to add as many Higgs fields with whatever charges we want. So there's no explanation in the standard model why, a priori, is there just a single Higgs field, and why does it have these particular charges that it's a singlet under SU3, doublet under SU2 with a certain hypercharge. But in this way, you do better. Basically, once you specify the symmetries, really, we specified the algebra, but anyway, its automorphisms are the symmetries. And once you specify how it talks to the fermions, how those symmetries act on the fermions, then there's a single unified calculation that forces you to add the usual gauge bosons up here, but also add the scalar field that we know and love in the standard model. And then there's some other advantages. I mean, so for example, in this table, you might ask, why is it that when we were filling in all the representations, we only ever saw singlet or fundamental representations? You know, the only things that appeared here were the fundamental representation or singlet representations of SU3, or the fundamental or singlet representations of SU2. But I mean, from an effective field theory standpoint, you know, SU2 has an infinite number of irreducible representations to choose from. There's the singlet, the fundamental, the doublet, but then there's the triplet, the quadruplet, the quintuplet. There's the infinite tower of SU2 representations. Why is it that in nature we only see the one and the two? And similarly, why is it that for the SU3 we only see the one and the three and not any of the higher representations? So from this standpoint, where the fundamental object is an algebra, and the gauge group is a derived object, the automorphism group of that algebra, that turns out to be explained. Why you only see singlets and fundamentals here. So anyway, that's it. So I think this is another promising lead. All of these various things that we've discussed through the course are various, you know, were selected to be what I regard as various promising leads for beyond the standard model physics. They clearly all relate to one another, but how exactly to put them all together, you know, I leave as a exercise. So that's it. Sorry. In keeping with tradition, I ran 5 minutes over. Anyway, so thanks for listening.